Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, great pyramids, spectacular monuments, and other superstructures were identified and celebrated as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. More recent Magnificent Sevens have included other man-made marvels, such as Machu Picchu, the Taj Mahal, or wonders of nature, such as the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the comedian, pod and broadcaster, Angela Barnes. Angela's appeared regularly on Mock the Week, as well as Stand Up for the Week, Russell Howard's Good News and Radio 4's News Quiz. So obviously very well used to finding the funny in current events. But she also created a radio series about the Cold War and co-hosts a podcast called We Are History, which allows her to take the same approach to days gone by as well. Now, Angela, you're well known to be one of the hardest working stand-ups in the comedy business. Are you naturally industrious, in big demand, or just making hay while the sun shines?
Exactly, making hay while the sun shines. That always makes me laugh, that statistic. I think there was one year where they counted up all the miles that we travelled on tour, and I came out to be the hardest working comedian in the country, or the third hardest working, I think it was. And when my agent phoned me to tell me, it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon and I was still in my pyjamas. And I just, I don't feel like the hardest working comedian in the country, but sure, if that's what they want to say, then that's great.
Well, you were still in your pyjamas because you'd been working the night before and the 10 nights before that, and you were catching breath before starting again that evening, obviously.
Obviously, that was it, Clive, obviously. I think, you know what it's like, we're essentially freelancers, and I'm still at that stage in my career where I'm scared to say no to anything because I think they won't ask me again. So, it's very much making hay while the sun shines, and but as I get older, that's definitely slowing down.
And just one other point I was going to just investigate for a moment, because I do remember that you, before you were a comedian, you had what you might call a proper job, working in the area of mental health, social care, that sort of thing, as well as running a comedy club. So does that inform your approach to work when it comes to standing on stage, getting laughs? It's work, but it's not perhaps the daily grind or the distressing work that might come with dealing with unfortunate lives.
Absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a history of, you've got Joe Brand and other people that end up in comedy that have come from working in mental health or working in healthcare, full stop. And I think it's because you do have to have a certain outlook on life. You do have, when you're working with people that are in crisis every day, if you didn't have a sense of humour about it, you wouldn't be able to get through the day, you know. So I think there's a reason we're drawn to comedy from that background. Yeah, I mean, the fact that I get to do this as a job now, I still pinch my... I was quite late when I started compared to a lot of people. You know, I did my first stand-up comedy open spot when I was 33. And so I'm still, can't quite believe that I'm allowed to do this and get paid for it. But here we are.
Yeah. No, but I mentioned in passing there, you were running a comedy club in your spare time. So had you harboured long-term ambitions to be a comedian yourself while booking others and, seeing how well or badly they were doing?
Well, I think, those ambitions were there, but I don't think I realised they were sort of dormant in me. And I think because I was a kind of working class woman, there weren't that many of us about doing comedy on television, you know, that you have Victoria Wood and Joe Brand and that was about it. And so it never really occurred to me that it was something I could do. It was something that clever boys did, you know, when I was growing up. And then I started running comedy clubs because I just loved watching it. And my dad was a big comedy fan and he would watch it with me. And he used to say to me, why don't you have a go? Why don't you get up there? And I'd be like, don't be stupid. That's not for me. And it was when my dad sadly passed away quite suddenly in 2008. And that's when I thought, do you know what? Life's short. Maybe I should give this a go. And here we are.
Yeah, no, yeah, he was quite young when he died. But you, that's interesting. You only, A, that you got encouragement for your father. Not all parents want to encourage their children to go into show business, you know, music or comedy, come to that. And sadly, you only got going once he was no longer there to see it, which is, I don't know if that's distressing or some sort of comfort. You think, well, I have done something that he suggested in the end.
Yeah. A bit of both, I think, life, because yeah, it's really sad when, you know, I'm doing things on TV or I'm, you know, doing tour shows or whatever, and I just think, oh, how much he would be loving this, you know, how much he would love to be seeing this. And it makes me really sad that he never got to see it, and never got to see me really be happy doing what I'm doing, you know. But the other side of it is maybe I wouldn't be doing it if he was still here, so maybe that's his gift to me, you know. He left us too young, but so that's what came out of it, if you like. So yeah, it's sort of mixed bag of feelings on it, really.
Of course, he did live on in your comedy act, because as many relations of comedians do. But he does sound like an extraordinary person. I don't want to, you know, go over all that again. But he ran a sex shop in Great Yarmouth, or I suspect the sex shop in Great Yarmouth, and
Yeah, he was, I think what people refer to him as a character a lot of the time. He was one of those, you know, he was a great dad, my dad. And it's funny because he was a swinger. He ran a set shop. He, you know, had all these facets to him. But to me, he was just my dad. And he was actually I was his little princess, you know, he was quite prudish when it came to me. But yeah, he was fairly liberal parenting, I think I can say.
Right, but he didn't encourage you to go into the sex shop business or the swinging part. I don't know.
I think he would have encouraged me if that had been my choice. But yeah, it wasn't forced upon me, shall we say?
Okay, all right. Let's get on with your wonders of the world. I think we've sketched that in quite. We've got quite a bit, you know, the people's background, especially in the way comedy is done these days, inevitably intrudes and inevitably forms part of the act in almost every case. But what is your first wonder? Has it got anything to do with your upbringing or where you were born or where you lived or what?
Sort of. Well, my first wonder, it's a big one, really, but it's just the sea. I wasn't brought up near the sea. I was brought up in Kent, so I was never far from the sea. I was brought up in Maidstone in Kent. But the sea was where
Which
we
is
went.
Not a coastal town. It's a,
not a coastal the town.
Maidstone
no.
is not a coastal town. In case people don't know the setup, it's not like Deal or any of those, you know, actual seaside places. It's on a river.
No. But we were, yeah, it's on the River Medway, but we were never far from the sea. You know, it was only an hour to get to the coast and we would go there. That was one of my dad's favourite things to do. So my parents divorced when I was young. And so I would see my dad on Sundays usually. And that's what we would do, is we would just get in the car and drive to the coast. It was a cheap day out. He never had much money, but, you know, we could get to the coast. And his favourite thing was to be at the seaside in the winter. He loved a sort of bleak seaside town, and the rule was that I wasn't allowed to get back in the car until I got my feet wet in the sea, however cold it was, whatever the time of year it was. I would go for a paddle, and so the sea for me is just where you go to have a nice time. And even now, so I now live in Brighton, and I think I studied at Sussex University. I came to Brighton to study, and I think that was in me, that I just needed to be by the sea. And I think what the sea does, it's a really good reminder to us that we're not the boss of the planet, you know, that it's just there. Mm-hmm. It's massive. It can cause problems if you don't respect it. And it's just, it's good to remind us human beings that we think that we're in charge, that actually we're not. And there's great bodies of water are there to remind us of that. And there's something as well, I think, about being on the coast. For some, I've got no sense of direction, Clive. I get lost in my own house, you know. I'm one of these people who just... every day, it's like when you wake up, you don't know which way you're facing. That's me all day long. But when I'm at the seaside, when I'm by the sea, I know where I am. It's a really good way to orientate yourself, you know, to know which way you're facing. I know where south is if I can see the water. So, yeah, there's just something I find calming about being in the water. I love swimming in the sea. And so, yeah, coming to live in Brighton, I get to do that every day. You know, we're recording this in a heat wave. And yesterday I spent pretty much all day in the sea, you know, so it's... yeah, it's a big part of my life.
So paddling in the sea, swimming in the sea. Since you've got a poor sense of direction, I'm assuming you don't go out much in boats, or at least not on your own, because you do need a pretty good sense of direction. Yeah.
No, I like to watch boats. I'm not a fan of being in boats very much. I can get a bit seasick, but I like to just be in the sea myself. That's the
Yes. Well, it's an interesting selection then. I gather the link with your father and being taken to the seaside. Did you have sort of fish and chips and stuff like that? Was that all part of the experience, sort of relaxed dining?
It was. Well, we used to take picnics. So, I don't want to do the old poor me, but we didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, to go out and buy fish and chips was quite an expense. So my nan would make us sandwiches, which would be lovely and sweaty by the time we got them to the seaside, you know, once they'd been in the car for a couple of hours. And so just sort of sweaty sandwiches and bags of crisps and sitting on the pebbles or on the sand and just looking at the sea and being in the sea and splashing about.
I'm sorry, we're almost becoming like the Yorkshireman in the
Monty Python. I know, we've got to be really careful about
fish and chips, luxury. you had a nan to make you sandwiches. But it's a sort of holiday place and an agreeable place. But you're not involved in fishing yourself or going in boats. It's a contemplative thing that the sea makes it into one of your wonders of the world.
Yeah, I mean, this might sound a bit strange, Clive, but I actually I've got quite a strong fish phobia. It's called ichthyophobia, and although I love swimming in the sea, this is what I love about British seasides, is the sea is so murky, I can tell my brain that there's definitely no fish in there, even though I know there are. Oh. I can't see them. Whereas if I swim in the Mediterranean or somewhere, I'm not so keen, because I can see the fish, and then I have to get out.
Well, if you go to, you put a snorkeling mask on or something like that in good amounts of seaside, you can see hundreds of fish that you don't realise you've been swimming amongst. So perhaps I shouldn't tell you that.
Yeah, I like to live in blissful ignorance about... I know they're there, but as long as I can't see them, I can convince my brain that they're not.
What's your second wonder?
So my second wonder, it's a book called... so it's quite specific that it's one book, but it's called Stasiland by Anna Funder. And the reason I've chosen this is Stasiland's a really good example of a book that is what I call like a really accessible history book. It's about the sort of East German regime, really, in the 20th century in Germany, and the East German Democratic Republic. And it's about the Stasi, which were the secret police. And she's an Australian author, Anna Funder. And what she did was she put classified ads in newspapers to contact ex-Stasi men, and she interviewed them. And then she also gathered these stories of resistance, really, from the East German people during that period. And so what I love about history is when I was at school, it was very much learning about kings and queens, and it was very dry history. And that never really appealed to me. I didn't think I liked history because I could never really see where history stopped and fairy tales began. You know, sort of go, oh, right, OK, King John was real, Princess and the Pea wasn't. OK, but in my head, they were all, you know, these sort of fairy tale figures that weren't real. Whereas to hear stories from people in my living memory, you know, I find that really exciting and much more engaging. And so I sort of developed a slight obsession with 20th century history, really. I think the Berlin Wall, it came down on my birthday. November the 9th, 1989 was my 13th birthday.
All right.
And I remember it being in the news, and I remember it being such a big event, obviously. And I just wanted to know everything about what was happening.
Did you feel it overshadowed your birthday, or did you see it as like a present from the world to you? That for that moment, that was one of those very optimistic moments in time, wasn't it?
It was. It was great. The celebrations. It felt like David Hasselhoff was singing just for me, Clive. You know, that's part of that whole celebration. And it was, I was learning German at school at the time. And so, you know, our German teacher was obviously telling us all about it. And I just found it really fascinating. And then it was about, I don't know, it must have been about 7 years ago, maybe, I read this book, Stasiland, by Anna Funder. And it's such a great example of this accessible history. And it was from there, really, that planted the seed that I'd never studied history. I never did it A-level or university, anything like that. So it sort of planted this seed that I wanted to learn more about history. And that's really where this idea for having a history podcast then came from, which I do with John O'Farrell.
Yes.
And so this book was really the start of getting to that point where I now have a sort of reasonably successful history podcast.
Well, I was just listening to your podcast in readiness for doing this one, and the listeners may not know, but you know, John O'Farrell's an old friend of mine, and it's a very jolly discussion. I mean, that's the point of it. It's sort of a light-hearted look at history. But the one I was listening to this morning was about the witch trials or the witch executions, specifically in Scotland, worldwide. And as I think you make the point, I think generally about your podcast, but certainly on that one, we're supposed to be making a cheery one, but this is about people being sort of torn from their homes, tortured, and then a good many of them executed by having being strangled and then burnt. So there wasn't much jollity in the basic
story.
Not
a lot of comedy to have out of that. No, I mean, I think the way we sort of pitch it is it's a light-hearted. It's two friends who are history nerds talking about something they've learnt about, and quite often that's how we choose the episodes. You know, one of us will have read a book about something, we go, oh, did you know about this, John? And sometimes there'll be, you know, much more well-known things, like we did an episode on Vlad the Impaler, or we did the Profumo affair, things that people think they know everything about, you know. And then so we say our sort of strap line for the podcast is we read the history books so you don't have to. So, you know, we'll read about it, we'll do the research, and then we'll chat about it in a sort of two friends down the pub talking about it sort of way. But like you say, obviously a lot of history is violent and dramatic and horrific. And so you have to have some deference to that. And there is a sort of, you have to find that balance between when to make the gags and when to just tell the story. I hope we tread that line pretty well, I think.
No, definitely. The one that did strike me, which I suppose it was just accidental, but it worked. I don't know if you listen to it as it goes out, but you were talking about obviously saying, well, many of these women were just people, you know, perhaps getting on a bit, but knew about plants and things and got the suspicions of people. And it was women picked on. And then the advert that came in after that moment was for a product, a herbal product for dealing with the menopause and the ancient.
No,
so I don't know
way.
Whether the advertiser thought that this is just the point to advertise herbal remedies to the, let's say, getting the older woman.
I had no idea about that, because they put the ads in after. And so we have no idea.
No,
what,
I know.
That's brilliant.
I know.
Oh, that's funny.
We had a less fortunate one on this podcast. Once we Paul Sinner. I don't know if you know Paul Sinner.
Who's
a chaser and a comedian and a doctor and everything. And this was a fascinating, if I may say so, discussion, or him telling us about his life. But along the way, he only seemed to have one regret. He'd had some stops and starts and doing different things. One regret, he'd been addicted to gambling for about 12 years. And that was in a dull part of his life. And he'd put that behind him. And there were several adverts around this podcast. And they were all from betting companies. So presumably they hadn't worked it out quite as well as your herbal remedy company, who had...
Oh dear. We had in our history podcast, if people don't know who John O'Farrell is, he's, I think it's fair to say he's slightly left of centre and, you know, a sort of keen campaigner for the Labour Party. And then we found out about six episodes in that it was the Telegraph being advertised during all of our episodes. So John put a stop to that. I loved it. The history podcast is such a little passion project of ours. And it's, you know, I didn't know John at all before we started doing it. I just followed him on Twitter and he'd been to see one of my Edinburgh shows. So he knew sort of who I was. And I just contacted him on Twitter one day and said, I really want to do a history podcast. I love your, because John had written sort of funny history books. I said, I really just wondered if you'd be interested in doing it with me. You know, I understand you're probably too busy, etc. And apparently he asked his daughter, who, you know, is in her 20s, said, should I do this? And Lily said, yes, you should, Dad. And here we are. And now we love right. it, you know, and it's, yeah, it's a really fun thing to do.
Well, it's an interesting general point as well, and I've had this discussion with all sorts of people who make, you know, history television programmes or radio podcasts, write books, and it's what you mentioned along the way there. A lot of people come away from school thinking, well, I wasn't interested in that. It was learning the dates of kings or battles, or it didn't seem to come alive. And yet, a lot of people love watching a good television documentary that, okay, it's usually about one of the wives of Henry VIII, but all those periods of history that they get, you know, gone over again and again. But people come to it later in life, and I just wonder why it is that the spark of interest does not catch fire at school with so many people who come to it later.
I think it's a lot to do with it just not feeling very relatable. You know, when you're at school, you're not learning about ordinary people, or certainly we weren't learning about the experience of ordinary people during these periods. You know, you were learning about kings and queens and you know, politicians and things that just didn't feel very accessible, or how did that affect the people just trying to live their lives, you know. And I think that's why I came into it very much from finding out about sort of stuff within living memory, really, you know, because I'm in my mid-40s now, and you get to an age where suddenly, you know, kids in history lessons at school are learning about things that you remember. You know, I remember being absolutely devastated to find out that 9/11 was on the A-level syllabus, you know, and you go, oh my God, I was in my 20s when that happened. Like that's, and you know, things like that. And so suddenly these things, that this idea of history is something that's real suddenly. And I mean, I'm still very much sort of my focus is on 20th century history. That's what I find really fascinating, stuff that is in my grandparents' living memory, shall we say. There's people you can still talk to about things that happened. And whereas John quite likes to go further back. I always say John's there to drag me back to the dark ages in the podcast, but in more ways than one, I'd say. But you know, he loves talking about things like the Black Death, and real medieval history is his passion. So I think that's why we work well together, because otherwise
he's a dark side to John, and he keeps well hidden, but it comes out in his topics.
It really does.
It's, odd enough, the witches in Scotland and James the Sixth and First, it's odd. It's in the ether at the moment. I do a show, a stand-up show, called Me, Macbeth and I, and it comes into that. This is the minor one, but Lucy Worsley has done a radio program about it, a television program about it, and here's you with your podcast. And as I think you mentioned, there's an apology granted to the convicted witches by the Scottish government, saying, well, we'll let you off that because you didn't actually commit a crime, you were just tortured into admitting some supernatural power that formed the basis of a witchcraft trial. And so it's obviously a thing at the moment, but and in any point, anything you discuss in a historical context, there's always something, as you say, relatable to today. You can say, oh, that's the way women are always treated, or this is how the people in power treat people who are not in power, or these are the clash of nationalities. And they do resonate with the modern world as well.
Before this Parliament right now is a petition demanding a pardon for the more than 4,000 people in Scotland, the vast majority of them women, accused and in many cases convicted and executed for being witches under the Witchcraft Act of 1563. And so today, on International Women's Day, as First Minister, on behalf of the Scottish Government, I am choosing to acknowledge that egregious historic injustice and extend a formal posthumous apology to all those accused, convicted, vilified or executed under the Witchcraft Act 1563.
Let's go on to your third wonder, which is One that I have a question mark against. I wonder why you have selected this.
I thought you might have a question mark against this one. My third wonder is concrete. Concrete, as in the building material, you know, highly popular in the mid to late 20th century. And I have a mild obsession with concrete. So I say concrete because it encompasses a lot of things. It's sort of slightly linked to my love of modern history and the Cold War era and things like that. So I'm quite obsessed with nuclear bunkers. I got interested in learning about Cold War defence stuff a few years ago. And so in the intervening years, I've visited quite a lot of Cold War era nuclear bunkers in the UK. But this is my engagement ring, which is a square of concrete. I don't know if you can see that, sort of set in silver. When my husband proposed to me, he knew I'm not a sort of fussy jewellery girl. I don't like, you know, you could buy me diamonds, but I probably would. I just wouldn't feel comfortable wearing them. They're not very me. And B, I lose things all the time. And, you know, losing a diamond is quite traumatic. So,
yes. So
I've got this bit of, and then our wedding rings, which you can't really see very clearly on here, but our wedding rings are also made of concrete. And the aggregate used for them, because we live in Brighton, is pebbles from Brighton Beach. So we went and picked some pebbles, some lovely colourful pebbles, and then we have the concrete rings made out of them, and they're sort of set in titanium. So my obsession with concrete is quite extreme. I think it's fair to say.
Oh, well, absolutely. You've proved your point here. But is this something that it's quite easy to do? Are there lots of places that say concrete rings made here? Or did you have to specially commission this and persuade somebody to make it?
We actually found a place. It was in Boston, in Massachusetts, that make concrete wedding rings. So I just sort of Googled it, thinking it was something we wouldn't be able to find. And there they were. And they were... they were just beautiful. So we commissioned those. My husband, the engagement ring, I'm not sure where he got that from, but that he found. And then, we commissioned the wedding
ring. Listeners to this podcast can't see what I can see vaguely being waved in front of the camera for me. But it looks like quite a substantial ring, that concrete ring, the one set in silver. I know all rings can be used like that, but it's could kind of be a knuckle duster, really, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to cross me, would you?
Hit somebody with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You meet me in a dark alley at night.
Not.
I think I'm.
Yeah.
So far, I haven't used it for those purposes.
Let me just understand. My research has got this far, which is not very far. Concrete is the second most used substance in the world after water. So there's a lot being made of it. And that's probably those statistics don't even include your rings that have been made out of it. So they may have put it above water now, for all I know. But your interest comes from this. It's nuclear bomb shelters.
Yeah, no, kind of. I think it's a mix of... It started as a sort of nostalgia thing. You know, I think I grew up in the 70s and 80s with, a lot of new concrete buildings coming up. And they get a lot of bad press, brutalist architecture. But I sort of love it because I have that nostalgia of growing up around it. And in fact, I recorded an episode of Mastermind recently, Celebrity Mastermind, and my specialist subject was brutalist architecture. So it's stuff that really...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I love things. You know, I loved the National Theatre and, Barbican, although that's sort of acceptable middle-class face of brutalism, I know, but Trellick Tower and all of those things that get such bad press that are only now, with time, you know, getting listed and getting seen as having historical significance and value and being part of that whole modernist movement of the 20th century. And I think they're beautiful. And there's fewer concrete structures now because there's a big environmental problem with using concrete as a building material. And so those, you know, that short, relatively short period of time in the 20th century when all those concrete buildings were going up, they're something I think we should preserve. They're an important part of our post-war history, you know.
Okay, yes. Well, then my other fact about it is the production of cement that goes into concrete is leads to 8% of global emissions. So it's quite a serious contributor to global warming. I suppose when it's made into buildings, you say it's brutalist, and some people like that stark look. Do you think it weathers well? You know, a stone building tends to sort of get a bit of a patina as the years go by, but concrete sometimes just looks sort of a bit greyer.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how they've done it, really. So you have different types of ways they've used it. So, for example, at the Barbican, I think it's weathered quite well because they bush hammered all the buildings there to bring the aggregate forward. So it always had that texture. And I think the textured concrete weathers a bit better than the smooth concrete, the sort of precast buildings maybe that can look a bit weather beaten. But then, you know, I look weather beaten as I get older. I don't necessarily find that a bad thing. And I think we're sort of, you know, we think our buildings need to be beautiful, not functional. And I think there's room for both. And like I said, like you said, that they're environmentally a problem. Now they realise concrete buildings. And so there's just this little window of time where they were really popular. And I think that should be preserved.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Number four, what's your fourth one? Well, I know what your fourth one is. It's radio, makes, I suppose, more sense because you make radio programmes. Presume you listen to radio programmes. But is that why, as a listener or a maker, that you've put radio on the list?
Both, really, Clive. So I, you know, grew up with radio being a huge part of my life. My dad absolutely loved radio comedy. He loved The Goons. I grew up listening to the News Quiz with my dad. You know, he just really loved, and the radio was always on in our house. And my mum listened to The Archers, and I still listen to The Archers to this day. It was when I went to university, I would never have told anyone that I listened to The Archers. I used to sneak off back to my rooms at 7 o'clock to listen to The Archers because it was just like getting a little hug from home. It was, you know, but of course now in the modern world, I can listen to it on the podcast, in the car, or whenever I've got time. I've never stopped listening to The Archers. It's been a huge part of my life. And just having Radio 4, it used to just be on in the house. And the great thing about Radio 4 just being on is you sort of learn things without realising you are. You know, you just learn things by accident, just having it on in the car, having it around the house. And I think the thing I love about radio as opposed to television is that you can sort of consume it while you're doing other things. So I've got ADHD, and so I find it very difficult to sit down and watch a television programme without doing anything else at the same time. I can get on with other stuff while the radio's on. And even when I was a kid, I used to spend my Sundays with my dad in the car, and he used to listen to Capitol Gold in the car. It used to play sort of 50s and 60s music. And I'd love it. And he used to test me on my knowledge of 60s music. You know, who sang this? Who produced this? And so I think that's why now I quite like quizzing, because my dad would just quiz me on all this music that we used to listen to in the car. So the radio, I just find, is just a medium that I've always loved and always is so important in my life. But I don't know if you know this about me, Clive, but I have quite severe hearing loss, so I wear hearing aids, and I'm always worried that, because you know, it gets worse, it degenerates the sort of hearing loss that I have, that one day, you know, I might not be able to enjoy the radio anymore, and that's quite a sad you know, thing to think about. But having, now that I get to make radio programs, so the news quiz, for example, like I say, I grew up listening to that with my dad, and the fact that I got to host a series of it and, you know, be a panelist on it, and it's stuff that I know my dad would be so proud of, and it's something I hope they always ask me to do, because it was the only job in comedy that I got really excited about when it was offered to me. When in 2011, I won the it was a BBC New Comedy Award, and I did an interview with a magazine, and they said, "What's your comedy ambition?" You know, and I said, "To be on the news quiz." That was all I wanted to do, was be on the news quiz. And and Victoria Lloyd was the producer at the time, and she read this interview I'd done, and she contacted me and said, "Would you like to come and do a day's writing on it?" Which I couldn't believe my luck, because again, to me at that time, you know, I was 34. I come from a very working class Kent background. People like me didn't get invited to come in and write on a Radio 4 programme, you know, out of nowhere. That just didn't happen. And so I didn't know the way in. I didn't know about these things. And so that was such a big moment in my career when I got to write on it. And then I got asked, you know, further down the line to be a panellist. And then in 2020, I got to host a series. So, yeah, it's just a huge part of my life.
Well, I think it's a very good. I mean, I appear on the radio myself, so I can scarcely not applaud going for the radio. But I suppose some people listening to this may say, well, there's two things they might ask. Well, I'm going to ask. One is, what about television? To be on the radio is great. Nice. I agree. Being on the news quiz, a great thing. But you do sort of similar programmes on television where you can be seen, you probably reach a bigger audience, it's a higher profile. I venture to suggest it's more money as well. Is radio like your first love that you just can't get over, but even though you might have moved on to a richer companion? I don't extend this idea too far, but you know what I mean? Does television not have the same sentimental appeal?
Exactly that. I think for me, you know, I did grow up watching television, but there's the radio will always have a special place in my heart. But unfortunately, as you know, as well as I do, Clive, that, you know, yes, you make more money in television and we've all got bills to pay. And also that profile thing. Yes. You know, as a stand up comedian, the most important thing in my career is touring. I love being on tour with my shows, and you know, in order to tour shows you need an audience, and in order to get an audience people need to know who you are. And so that's why doing TV shows is important, because more people watch TV than listen to the radio. That's just the numbers game.
Now, more people who go out to see shows watch television. The news quiz has a loyal audience, but they aren't all the type or even age of person who's going to go down to the their local stadium to book to see one of your...
Oh, I love that you think that tours. I'd be bothering any local stadiums, Clive. That's luckily for me, what people who listen to the news quiz do tend to go to their local arts centre. So that's more my...
Yeah.
Where I'm aiming for, really. But the thing I love about radio as well over TV is I don't have to worry about what I'm wearing or brushing my hair, or, you know, people are only commenting on what you're saying. As a stand-up comic, I find it... Really, as a woman on TV, even though my job is a, you know, essentially a clown, I still get comments on my looks. I get comments on what I'm wearing. I get comments on whether I've lost weight or not, you know, whether I've put weight on, you know, all of that stuff that you just get bombarded with. You know, men get it as well, but particularly as a woman on TV, they're more focused on what I look like than what I'm saying. Whereas on the radio, I don't have that issue. It's just on what I'm saying. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is my job's words, not looks.
No, I understand what you're saying, but where are you getting those comments? Is this because of the, you know, Twitter and other social media that people might have thought all these sort of things years and years ago, but apart from, let's say, one reviewer every now and then, you probably didn't need to know, or there was no way of knowing what people were saying. But is this a function of our interconnected age?
Absolutely. It's Twitter, it's whatever, you know, and I'm not, you know, I don't go looking for what people are saying about me on Twitter, because that way madness lies, you know, and you have to just ignore it and you have to not engage with it. Because like you said, people obviously thought those things about people on telly in the past, but they didn't have a way to directly tell that person what they thought of them. And now people do, you know, and they will tag you in a tweet. So to make sure that you see it. And I've got a pretty thick skin, Clive, most of the time. But some days, if you're having a bit of a wobbly day or you're not feeling 100%, you know, and you suddenly someone's saying something awful about the way you look, or, you know, things that you've already got insecurities about, it can affect you. You're just a human being. And I think people forget that you're a human being at the end of those tweets, you know, and they think they... People extrapolate from jokes that you make and things that you say on television, and they think they know who you are as an entire person and what you're like and what your opinions are on everything and what your politics are on everything. And the fact is, they don't know anything about me or what I'm like and what sort of person I am. So it can be really hurtful when you see that stuff, you know, and you ignore it most of the time, and some days it just gets to you. But that's the world we're in now, unfortunately.
Right. Well, I was going to message this, I suppose, slightly more flippant. Well, I don't know. It's a slightly different question. I was just wondering, here we are talking on a podcast. We've been talking about your podcast you do with John O'Farrell. Do you think the existence of these sorts of things may undermine radio? Are we two radio lovers here talking in using a medium or a way of doing it that might eventually sort of death knell to things like specifically Radio 4, which is lots of constructed programmes, which takes a little bit more expense to make than other forms of radio?
Yeah, maybe we're part of the problem when it comes to radio. I mean, I think that the thing with something like Radio 4 is that randomness of it, is that, you know, if you're listening to podcasts, you're choosing what podcast you want to listen to, which is great. You know, so you go, what am I interested in? I'll find a podcast about that. Whereas if you just have the radio on in the house all day, you might end up listening to programmes you wouldn't necessarily have chosen to listen to, but actually you really get something out of it. And I sort of miss that randomness. And it's the same with music now. You know, I find myself, just because of Spotify and because of being able to listen to, you know, music really easily, I very rarely go searching for new things now. I just know what I like and I listen to it. And I was thinking about that the other day, about how I miss just having the radio on and going, oh, I like this song. What's this band? Oh, I'll go and search out more of stuff they've done, you know. And so that's why I think radio is important for serving you up things that you might not have realised you wanted. So I hope it stays, and I hope we don't, we're not part of the problem there.
In this programme, we'll be looking back at 40 glorious years of the News Quiz, a programme that in its time has seen 7 Prime Ministers and 7 Presidents of the United States, and didn't, in all honesty, think very much of any of them.
This is, I mean, all politicians lose elections from time to time, but the Conservatives, 2 years in a row, have lost an election they didn't even need to have. The next leader will just decide, let's have a referendum on whether we should change our national language to Danish. And they go, oh, no! Lost it! No, it's been Danish! No! Genius!
Okay, very good. Angela, let's go on to your fifth wonder, though, if we may.
My fifth wonder is the Muppets, as in Jim Henson's creations. I just think the Muppet Show was the perfect family entertainment TV show. It was such a part of my childhood. My whole family would sit and watch the Muppet Show on a Saturday evening, and it had something for it. Like, kids could enjoy it because it's big puppets, adults could enjoy it because there were lots of little in jokes in it for the grown-ups, and it was just beautifully done. You know, who doesn't love the love story of Kermit and Miss Piggy? Who doesn't love that Jim Henson world that when you're in it, you just completely don't question anything about the fact that they're big, you know, made of felt and have ping pong balls for eyes. And it's just a beautiful world that I wish I could live in.
Well, you are living in it.
I am.
But the Muppets is a sort of old-fashioned variety show, but in puppet form, broadcast and getting in all sorts of other things. Well, that's your life, isn't it? You're an old-fashioned variety entertainer, getting involved in radio, podcast, television, on stage, touring. That is your life. You are a Muppet, is what I said.
Oh, you just made my day. I am a Muppet. I am. Oh, how wonderful. I just think they're so beautifully emotive, the Muppets, as well. For puppets, which, you know, the people that operate them are so clever that you can, you know, I've cried at Muppet films. The first song I remember that ever made me cry was when I was little, and it was Kermit's nephew Robin singing Halfway Down the Stairs, you know, the A.A. Milne thing, and they that version of that. Yeah. I can remember, I was only little when I first heard it, and I remember it making me cry and thinking, what is this? How is music making me cry? This melancholy sort of feeling. And it was just so beautifully done, just little Robin sitting on the stairs singing the song. And it's simple but so effective.
Yeah, and the Muppets Christmas Carol is one of the great versions of a Dickens novel ever committed to celluloid.
Absolutely. Every Christmas that comes out, and it's just so well done. So, and all the Muppet films are great. We had, for the first dance at our wedding, we had Kermit the Frog singing Rainbow Connection from the Muppet movie. That was our first dance.
Well, I can only admire you for the commitment that you have to your wonders. Some people do this podcast with, they just come the first seven things that come to their head. Others go right back into their childhood and their emotions. Fine. But you've gone a stage beyond, one step beyond. You've been living your wonders. Indeed, you're wearing a bit of concrete. You've used the Muppet song. It's extraordinary. All right. Any particular Muppet character that you either identify with or think is particularly well done? Or, I mean, you've obviously mentioned Kermit. He's kind of the ringmaster, the star. But are there others there that you think, that's such a good observation?
I do love Kermit because Kermit's us, isn't he? Kermit's the audience in this crazy Muppet world. He's our sort of connection to it. But I think for me, it always has to be Fozzie Bear. He's a stand-up comedian, Fozzie Bear.
Oh, right.
I remember when I was little, I bought my dad a little Fozzie Bear toy that he kept his whole life, and I've got it now. And it's just a Fozzie Bear, little plastic Fozzie Bear, and he's sort of stood at a microphone and he's got his arms held out wide and it just says, "It's no joke, Dad, I love you this much," is what it says underneath it. And so Fozzie Bear was always our favourite, me and my dad, when I was growing up. And so maybe that's, you know, my inspiration. Maybe that's why I'm a stand-up comic.
Time for fun with Fozzie Bear. Here's some jokes from everywhere.
Hey, it's that silly bear.
It's time for the audience to go elsewhere.
If you don't mind, I'll do the jokes.
We don't mind, but when are you going to do them?
All right. Now, look, we're going to move on to your sixth wonder, if we may.
Okay. So my sixth wonder is other people's babies, Clive. And the other people's in that is the important bit, because I don't have any babies of my own. So I don't want people to think, oh, she loves other people's children more than her own. I am voluntarily child-free. I'm 45, so I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I always say my reproductive system now is like an Asda on an Easter Monday. There's some eggs left, but they're the rubbish ones. So, you know, I don't think that's going to change. But people think that when you're voluntarily childless, that you don't like children. Mm. And that's not true. I love babies. I love holding babies. I love smelling babies. I think babies are brilliant. And so, you know, friends think that I don't want to see their babies or I don't want to hear about their babies just because I haven't got any. But it's not true. Babies are the future. They're brilliant.
Yeah.
I just made a very conscious choice in my life that motherhood wasn't for me. I never had that calling to be a mother. And people used to say to me, "Oh, when you get older, it'll come." Well, I'm 45 now, and it never came. I understand biological urges that people have. It's just mine have all been for carbs, not for babies. So, and people make lots of assumptions about couples that have chosen not to have children, and they really upset me because there's an assumption that we're somehow selfish and that's why we haven't chosen to have children, or we lack empathy and we don't care about other human beings and things like that. And I find that really bizarre because as far as I see it, I do love other human beings. I do care about the planet and people. And, you know, before I became a stand-up comedian, I worked in social care and healthcare professions. You know, I do have empathy is something I have, but I don't feel that comes from just having created something with your own genes. You know, I'm more suspicious of this idea that you can't have empathy for other human beings until you've created one. Mm. Well, I said, well, how does that make me the selfish person then, in that you only started caring about other people when you've made one with, you know, your genetic makeup? And this whole idea that we can't be compassionate as non-parents is great. Piers Morgan's got children, you know. It doesn't work like that. Some people are compassionate, some people aren't. That's and there's a good evolutionary argument for not having children. You know, in ancient human communities, or sort of, you know, the first human communities, if you like, when we're wandering the savannah, childless people were very important, because if everybody had children, no one was gathering the food. No one would, you know, it's that whole takes a village to raise a child. You needed childless people within your community. So this idea that women who don't want children are somehow, you know, not normal or unnatural is rubbish, because we're just that those ancient feelings within us have as much validity as those ancient feelings within people that want to have children. But for some reason, we're sort of snubbed and shunned and looked at like we're not real women and not real useful human beings because we haven't procreated. And that's something that really upsets me, because I don't hate children. It wasn't for me. And my family's huge. I've got a family with a Catholic background. I've got 41 first cousins. I don't need to procreate. You know, this idea that there's enough of us, there's enough of my genes out there. I don't need to. And often the people that get most angry, I think, about a woman who's chosen not to be a mother are the same people who are also angry about things like high levels of immigration. And, you know, it's that same. And I find that bizarre, because I think, well, are we full up or aren't we? You know, pick a team. Because if you think that we're too full up to allow immigrants in, yet you think I should be having children, then that doesn't add up, does it? You know, so there's this whole narrative about what being a woman is.
Well, I think in world terms, I think we've got enough people. You know, it's something approaching 8 billion now. So I don't think there's a duty or any obligation to have children if you don't want to. I try and obey two rules in relation to this. One, never say to a woman, are you pregnant then? Because she looks as though she might be pregnant. You never say that, because you might be right 100 times in a row, but the 101st time, you're going to cause offence. And the other thing is, I would never say to somebody, man or woman, why don't you have children then? Because there's a whole heap of, if they want to tell you, they'll tell you. And sometimes it's they're desperate to have a child and they can't. Mm. Sometimes they're desperate not to have a child and they don't want to be asked about it. So the only thing I would query here is that most people end up finding other people's babies rather boring. They're happy to show pictures of their children, but they don't want to look at anybody else's. So that's quite noble of you, in a way, to elevate other people's babies to this status of a wonder, and or even to be prepared to look at them and go, oh yes, that one, your child is, in fact, I would think, probably the most beautiful baby in the world. It hadn't occurred to me until now that there were such levels of difference, but yes, yours is clearly the most beautiful, and you have to say that to each and every person who shows you their photographs.
See, I'm quite happy with that arrangement, but I think I would say that the key word is babies, because once they're sort of running around and can talk back, I'm not so interested then. I like babies because, you can cuddle them and then you put them down, they don't move. That's the state, my favourite stage of childhood, I think. And I do, I've got friends who have kids and I do love my friends' kids, and I take them out and I treat them and I spoil them and I babysit them, and I do love the kids that are close to me. But, you know, big groups of children en masse, I find that difficult, you know. It's like, I have a real problem with sort of big groups of performing children, you know, singing, dancing. I'm sure if your child is in there singing, then that's beautiful. But I'll give that a miss if that's all right.
All right. Well, that's perhaps something you're spared, the school concerts, when every child has to do something. Every child has to be in the chorus, whether they want to be there or not, whether they can hold a tune or not. So babies you like. Mm-hmm. Not so much keen on children. What's the next age up that you kick back in? When they're 25 or a grumpy teenager?
Oh, I think, no,
35? What's the...
I think for me, it's the point where you don't have to mind your language too much around them anymore. You know, when you don't... Sort of 14, 15, when they know what's what and you can have a proper adult conversation with them, then that sort of kicks back in. Then they're fun again, you know. But there's that bit where they're impressionable. I find that too much pressure on me to not, you know, ruin their lives.
All right, that was your sixth wonder, other people's babies. And And again, a slightly surprising one to end on, your seventh wonder.
So my seventh wonder is a place called Newfoundland, which, if people don't know where Newfoundland is, it's a little island just off the east of Canada. And Newfoundland is, it's where my mum's family are from. So my granddad was born and brought up in Newfoundland.
Right.
Yeah. And so I have this family connection with Newfoundland that's been there obviously my whole life. And my granddad, I was quite young when he died, but he, my mum is one of nine children and they were brought up over here in Kent. And my granddad, who came from Newfoundland, he fought with the Newfoundland Regiment. So he came over here during the war, met my grandmother. They fell in love in Kent. They went back to Newfoundland. And my grandmother went back to Newfoundland on a troop ship after World War II. She was 8 months pregnant. They were married. And she did that voyage back to Newfoundland and arrived, I think, in 1945, 1946, arrived back there in the middle of winter. And she was a girl from Kent in a Newfoundland winter where it's, you know, minus 20 degrees, there's snow up to the top of your house. And this is in the 40s. You didn't have all the mod cons to deal with that they have today. And I think it's fair to say it was a bit of a shell shock for this woman from Kent. So they stayed there a couple of years and then they came back again and raised their family in Kent, because my grandmother just got too homesick. They raised their family in Kent, and they were in a council house in a place called Swanley in Kent. They had nine children in a three-bedroom council house, and so they didn't ever have money to go back. My granddad never got to go back to Newfoundland. And so growing up, there was this sort of place that was talked about by my grandparents and my family it might as well have been Mars for how inaccessible it was to us growing up. You know, I didn't even go on holiday to Europe with my family, let alone go somewhere transatlantic. You know, we had camping holidays 20 miles from where we lived. That was our holidays when I was growing up, or pontins, or, you know, things like that.
You went to another part of Kent.
Absolutely, we did. We'd go down to Dymchurch, you know, or we'd go to, that's what you did. And then, so there was just this place full of these relatives that we never met and we never saw, and this magical place that I could only imagine and I'd seen photographs of, and this snowy wonderland and things. And occasionally one of my Newfoundland relatives would come and visit us in Kent, and it was just like royalty coming to, we were so excited, and their accents were so crazy. Because I don't know if you've heard a Newfoundland accent, if you've maybe if you've watched Come From Away, the musical, which is set in Newfoundland.
Yes.
It's this sort of beautiful Irish sounding. Everyone thought my granddad was Irish when they heard him speak. And so it's so exotic that we were related to these people, but it was so far away. And it's only as we've become adults that suddenly getting to Newfoundland was, you know, something we could afford to do. And so as an adult, I've been several times, and I've made this connection with my cousins and my family in Newfoundland that I never had growing up. And it's such an incredible, beautiful place, Newfoundland. It's the size of England and Wales, but only 500,000 people live there. It's very rugged coastline, it's fishing communities, it's beautiful little towns on bays. And about 6-7 years ago, I took my husband there for the first time. We went to a little town called Ship Harbour. And Ship Harbour is where my granddad was born. And it's also, it's quite famous, Ship Harbour, because it's where Churchill and Roosevelt signed the North Atlantic Treaty. The boat came into, because obviously it's a midpoint in the Atlantic, and the boat came into harbour at Ship Harbour, and that's where they signed it. So it's got this historical significance. And I took my husband there, and we went with my cousin Dot, and we visited. And it's a population, Ship Harbour, of about 200 people, tiny little village. And out of those 200 people, there are just two surnames. And those two surnames are Griffiths, which was my granddad's surname, and Griffin. So I think it's fair to say not much of a gene pool in the area.
Yeah.
And we were sort of walking around and we got talking to a guy on the street and we just got chatting. And I got excited. I said, oh, I think that makes you my cousin. And he said, we're all cousins here. I thought, oh, yeah, I suppose we are.
Yes.
And it was just sort of walking around this town where everyone looked a little bit like us. You know, everyone, it's like walking through a hall of mirrors. But it's just, it's an incredible place and such a hospitable, like the people there are so welcoming and the food is, I mean, I think that my love of sort of carbs and sugary food is because of my Newfoundland genetics. You know, in Newfoundland, you ate salt and fat and sugar to keep you going through the winters. You know, and I think I've got those genes, but I had them in Kent, you know, where they didn't really fulfil the purpose. And also probably explains why I love the sea so much. It's very much, you know, the communities are all based on the coast. Yes. It's all fishing communities and this sort of, and it's just, it's an incredible place. And people don't really know about it. They don't, you know, from Britain, certainly people don't tend to go on holiday to Newfoundland.
Well, as you say, the musical Come From Away sort of illustrates a lot of those things. I think they were, I've seen the show and they're doing, you know, a Newfoundland accent, because people think, well, that's a strange accent you're doing. That's a bit weird. You're trying to do Canadian and failing. But it's a bit Irish, a bit Scottish, a bit West Country English, a bit this and that. But still a slightly unusual thing for somebody from Newfoundland to end up married to a sex shop owner in Kent, and from a Catholic background, a religious background, maybe. It all sounds a bit of a strange combination of things to have gone on. I suppose that came from the mixing up of wartime and bringing people together and refreshing the gene pool in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, the family story is that apparently, so when my granddad was stationed in a place called Crockenhill in Kent, where he was staying during the war, and he was out one day and he split his trousers, and my grandmother's brother was with him and said, oh, my sister will sew those for you. And so they went back to the house and my grandmother sewed up his split trousers, and that's how they met. So we always say, you know, if my granddad hadn't split his trousers on that day, none of us would be here. And I love those sort of sliding doors moments, you know, that this man from Newfoundland split his trousers and now I'm here talking to Clive Anderson, you know.
Well, maybe your grandfather was cleverer than you allow, and he was arranging to split his trousers every now and then on the off chance a comely local girl would get involved. Look, we've wildly overrun our time. They've been a brilliant selection of wonders, if I may say so, because some looked a bit going off in weird directions, and others a bit more obvious, but they all kind of tie together, and you're clearly very much involved in your family and your family background. Even the sea and your interests seem to all stem in that way, and so it's been quite a warming selection of seven wonders, if I may say so. Thank you for sharing them with us. I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described on the podcast. While you were getting so enthusiastic about concrete, I thought, that'll be great. I'll include concrete because it'll be such an odd one to be the wonder of wonders. But I'm going to appoint myself an editor of your wonders, and I'm going to go for the Muppets, but not all the Muppets. But I think the Fozzie Bear toy, the Fozzie Bear figure that you gave to your father, I think encapsulates a lot about what you've been saying about your relationship with him and the rest of your family, and comedy and performing and everything else. So it brought a tear to my eye the way that you were told us about that. So I'm going to make the Fozzie Bear Muppet figure. Shall we call it a figure? The Fozzie Bear Muppet figure as the wonder of wonders.
Oh, I'm really pleased with that, Clive.
Oh, good. If you enjoyed listening to My Seven Wonders, it'd be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform, site or provider you found us on. Thank you very much for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.